Hi, this is Kalyan Karmakar, and welcome to my podcast on books, which is called Eating Books. There's not so much on food, but we'll see that. But I've got a very, very special guest today, and the book is not on her. She's the author of the book, though someday there'll be a fabulous book on her. Welcome, Bachi Karkaria. Yes, so great to have you on board.
Thank you.
So Bachi and I go back a very, very long way. Except she doesn't know that. So almost 20
can't
years.
Can't be that long away. It's not like about 100 years younger than I am.
No. But we go back at least 20 years, and you have no idea of that, which makes me sound like a stalker. So let me explain why. When I was new to Bombay and I was working in advertising and had a lot of time to kill in the afternoon, I think I was reading The Midday and there was your column, unless it was in the TOI, early 90s. Early 2000s, where you'd written this article about Parsi moms and their sons and Bengali moms and their sons and the similarity. And about a year later, I ended up marrying a Parsi. So if the panchayat is upset about it, we know whom to blame. But absolute pleasure to have you on board. And Bachi's written this book, which is on Captain Nair, the late Captain Nair, whom most of us know perhaps as the founder and the person behind the Leela Hotel Group. But there's so much more to his story. And Bachi, the first question which I wanted to ask you was not so much about the book, but about the process of writing the book. In fact, towards the end in the acknowledgement, you've said a very interesting line, which I found very interesting, where you said that writing nonfiction is akin to working at an archaeological site. Did you know Captain Nair? I mean, have you met
him? No. He died in 2014. And Kalyan, actually, they had the Leela Group, the sons, had really wanted this book, for his centenary. Well, actually, Captain Nair had wanted a book for himself, and they had commissioned a writer who shall remain nameless, but who did allegedly work on the book for several years, because in fact, he had the advantage of Captain Nair being around when the book was commissioned. In fact, Captain Nair himself commissioned this writer, but this writer, for some reason, did not deliver at all. And then when the sons realized that, the centenary is now upon them, which was actually on February the 9th of this year, the birth centenary. And then they came to me in great desperation and said, will you do it? And I said, well, I didn't know much about Leela. I certainly didn't know much about Captain Nair, but they brought with them an AV by Vijay Amrit Raj, who was very close to him, much younger, but very close. And it just stunned me because the kind of things that Vijay Amrit Raj told me about this book, about the man, I said, oh my God. And especially the fact that, he'd been this very poor boy in Kannur, and then, he'd risen to these heights. And we know so many of these literally rags to riches stories. But more interesting, what appealed to me directly was the fact that he was the one who had promoted Bleeding Madras. You're probably too young, but Bleeding Madras was the fabric, which was the rage of the 60s and the 70s, and international rage. And like the Guru shirt, it came back to us, via the West. And yes, he was the man who had actually promoted it. There had been this importer who had come. The textile commissioner put him in touch with Captain Nair. Captain Nair showed him this fabric, and the appeal of it was that it changes with every wash.
I love that way of spinning the story. I was telling Kanas, my wife was in advertising, they took the weakness and made it a strength.
Absolutely. And he's doing that throughout. And really, he was doing it through everything. He just took this weakness and turned it into a strength.
So I must say that I did try to choose a shirt which bleeds a bit of color, though these Fab India shirts don't bleed as much colors as it did 15-20 years back. It was the biggest fear when you're kids and you're from Calcutta. Wrong uthe jave, and everything else gets colored. And that's what also happened.
And the thing is that everything else gets colored, but but it doesn't get colored the way, you know, Bleeding Madras literally, you know, it bleeds. And in fact, that is what, you know, so when Brooks Brothers brought the entire consignment and it just flew off the shelves, but they forgot this crucial factor of in mild water, not with other colors. And of course, you know, like that Peter Sellers, you know, song about washing, you know, colors into whites, into colors you've never seen.
So
they were terribly sued. But of course, the captain said, look, I told you, it's not my fault. And in fact, they again turned it around. And so David Ogilvy, you know, put in the line and said, guaranteed to bleed.
And we have an Ogilvy girl in the other room. My wife, who's with Ogilvy, Kapasi, of course. So, yeah. But I just love that story of the Bleeding Madras anecdote, which was really amazing, and how he turned a weakness around. But from what I understand, you wrote a large part of the book actually in lockdown, in custody, in the pandemic. And you might have had to piece so many pieces of the jigsaw together to get this book. So how did you do that?
Well, they did approach me one day before lockdown, and that's the only day that they could come. So they said, look, we are coming. So
I said, but before the second lockdown?
The second lockdown,
yeah,
yes.
So,
I was in the process. I was really in the process of completing my long-form book, long-form essay, which was like a mini book for Westland. And I said, look, you know, I can't do anything, you know, right now, but I cannot spend the time and go to Leela, which is a 1 hour here, one hour back, plus however much time. So they said, no, we'll come. So I said, okay, please come to my humble home. And then they came, but then they had an autobiography of Captain Nair, which was in Malayalam, but of course it was in an English translation. And so I spent the first less than that. Because remember, I had a 7-month deadline to do this book.
So not 7 years, unlike the earlier author.
Not unlike 7 years. And I did produce, you know, I mean, so I did produce a baby at the end of it. Right? And so I spent the, and they kept saying, when you come into the hotel, I said, look, I cannot come. Let me just get my teeth into this. So I spent the first maybe 6 weeks working on the basis of the autobiography. Of course, as you know, autobiographies are great indulgences, and you know, there's very little, you know, great economy of truth. And so you had to check everything. And certainly things like timelines, you know, when you're sort of, you know, expanding and pontificating, you know, you're not really worried about things like, hey, you know, this the man you're talking about, he certainly wasn't the chief minister in this year. You know, so the timelines were one of the most difficult parts of this book to do. I had somehow glossed over them as much as I could, but the publisher, the editor, kind of came back at me and said, no, we need, and it was really important, because that way we did avoid fairly serious bloomers. And you know, Kalyan, I sometimes think that there's really someone there watching over me. And I'm sure all writers have this guardian angel, because, you know, you just, you know, are warned about something and then you're spared from very, very red faces afterwards.
But I think a bit of your journalistic training also would have helped to sort of look for the facts.
Of course, the journalistic training does so help you to cut to the chase. And if I can just go back to my previous book.
Yeah, because you've written one on the M.S. Oberoi also.
Not so much the M.S. Oberoi book. That was 20 years ago.
So you mean the Nanavati book?
Nanavati book. So there my journalistic training just so helped in the fact of cutting to the chase, you know, knocking out the faff, getting to the truth of the matter, you know, really asking the crucial questions. So, you know, those things, of course, I mean, look, I'm much more a journalist than I am a writer. I don't even pretend to be an author.
Well, I mean, one can always sort of quibble about what is the definition of a writer. I think that, some people who sort of stress or spend too much time thinking about that while others write.
The nicest thing I liked about the reviews, and like the reviews for the Nanavati book, were like overwhelming, you know, because I think all the lawyers, all the people, and you had been there. In fact, I believe it was being talked about in the Central Hall of Parliament.
Wow.
Yeah, because you know, so many people had been, you know, very junior at that time. But the nicest thing I liked was the reviewer who said that it's the finest piece of investigative reporting. Wow. So that really pleased me. And
and then it made into a movie, OTT series.
Movie was before that. The movie was before that, and the movie was a disaster, let me tell you that.
Yeah, I mean, that was very...
It was all about Akshay Kumar and...
Yeah.
You know, and what really bugged me was that this absolutely suave and wonderful R.K. Karanja, who actually had fought the battle on the street, you know, for Nanavati, they made him out to be some utter buffoon, and they got everything wrong. They didn't even get the epaulets of the Navy wrong. And when I went to talk to the Navy people, they were like so angry to come back to Captain Nair.
Yes,
so I hope
for
that investigative reporting in this.
Yeah, so I must tell you, Vachi, when I heard about the book and I waited for the copy, because I can't read books on a screen or something like that. It's a disservice to a book. Now, I thought that, okay, it's going to be a book on a hotelier, and it's going to be about learnings which you can have on the hotel industry and a captain of industry and all of that. And that's not the sort of book which I generally tend to read, because, you know, one reads a lot of work-related stuff on the internet, in columns, this, that. And when it comes to reading, I like... either fiction or even if it's biographies, it's with people who got nothing to do with the trade, because for me, reading is about unwinding. And then I got this book, and I was supposed to interview you the next day. And then I said, no, Bachi, I can't interview you, because this is like a Jeffrey Archer novel. You know, and I mean that in a good sense, you know, the Cain and Abel sort of stuff which we grew up. It was so riveting. It was, you know, I mean, so was that the brief to you? Because, or did the sons sort of expect more like a, you know,
I was not given any brief. I was really not given any brief. And I mean, because the Oberoi book ultimately became into some kind of business manual, which was not...
And I have the Oberoi Grand book, which he wrote that first. Because the hotel's very close to my heart.
Yeah, so I thought I would start bringing in business mantras, but actually Rajiv cautioned me, and he said, you know, things have moved on since the time you wrote the Oberoi book. So don't get too hung up about the business mantras. I said, who's your target? He said, well, I guess, you know, anyone who's come in touch with the Leela Hotels, certainly the Kerala crowd, which is why I actually added a chapter.
Kerala, he's a Kerala boy.
I kind of took it out from the rest of the book and collated it and put it into a separate chapter called Kerala Boy, which is important, because he was, you know, however much he was this suave man of the world in his Bijon suits and his orchid essence.
Orchid.
aftershave. But he still was most comfortable in his, you know, in his vishti and his, you know, his Kerala mundu and stuff like that. And he was in fact, one of the headlines that the titles that I would have liked was Curries and Caviar. You know, that's what that man was.
But that is so nice. I mean, I must say it's more memorable than Capture the Dream, but it's okay.
I mean, I hate this title.
Yeah,
it was slightly better than what the family wanted, something like a memorable journey. And I'm glad my publisher said that it's the most unmemorable title to remember.
I do find this title a bit, sometimes I forget, I refer to it as Captain Nair's book, but Caviar, you know, I did wonder a bit about that chapter towards the end, because I don't know if you've read Sunny Days by Gavaskar. I mean, I did that when I was in school, and you know, it's about the start of his life till 76, and once he finishes that, there are suddenly two chapters which are about cricketers who didn't play in, Indian Idol or in Idols, but which, you know, the narrative got over, and then there were two chapters which are like about people in his life and things. So I did wonder a bit that why a couple of chapters at the end, but I think it's almost like a book finished and then there was...
You had to build a man. And I think this is all the building up of the man. Was really
so in a way, that was a footnote, perhaps, the chapter.
The Kerala chapter? And all that?
No, the Kerala and all of that. Because the story ended.
I don't think it was a footnote. I think it was very crucial to have that chapter, because that is what he was.
Okay, maybe not a footnote, perhaps what we used to call an executive summary and you know, marketing and all that, which sort of, because you see, you've got the story going on, and then you're sort of capturing the essence. But we won't quibble on that. But what I wanted to tell you, Bachi, and anyone who's you know, watching this, all 14 of you, that it's not. Yeah, it looks like a bit like a Business Today sort of cover, Business India sort of cover. But and no disrespect to them, it's a very, very interesting book. It's the sort of book which you can lie on the bed and read, which is the sort of book which I, and now mom's not around in Bombay to tell me chokhara phayave, you know, if you're lying on the bed and read. I did spend a bit of time in the tub with Captain Nair. I was on a holiday and reading the book, but that sounds a bit okay. Now I want to ask a few things which struck me about Captain Nair and his journey, and his life itself was 94 years. So in a way, you have actually documented through his life a certain story of India from pre-independence to you know, post-liberalization years. And there were a few things which struck me before that, because the hotel bit actually starts after about 100 pages and when he's 65 years old. Yeah. So
when he was 65, yes.
Yeah, which is when he should be he should be retiring. I mean, he should have retired. And nowadays people want to retire when they're 40 and all that. Ads, 20, you know, from banks.
21 and done.
Mm. 1 year of work and then you want to be have a privy purse. Yeah. We're all princes. Huh. So see, you know, my associations with Kerala, I mean, leaving aside socialism, football and all that, was when I was growing up, it's the one state which had 100% literacy. You know, that's the thing drummed in social studies and all of that.
Yeah.
Then a few years back, it was this entire God Zone country sort of thing, visual and this. And then in the past few years, also as a food person and someone who looks at food socially. And then I did go to Kerala just before the lockdown in Christmas, finally, to Cochin, just the thing. And saw that it's one place where, at least on the surface, there seems to be a fair bit of unity. You might find a toddy shop or a beef paratha shop where there could be a Hindu, Muslim, a Christian sitting together and you know, eating the same thing, drinking the same thing. Yet, when I read the initial chapters of the book, you know, you've spoken about how, first of all, he came from a poor family and also came from a lower caste, you know, it's not a Brahmin caste and all that. Yes. And it's not something which one associates today so much with Kerala as maybe some of the other southern states.
But
so,
Kalyan, they had a very, very rigid caste hierarchy, the Nambudris, the, you know, actually, this is the strange thing about Kerala when you said this, that, you know, it's sort of the minorities, the Christians and the Muslims, you know, together make up for 50%. So, you know, there is this very nice mix, but at the same time, it does not take away anything. And despite the communism.
Because Nambudripad was a chief minister,
and I
right?
know that
Nambudripad was a chief minister.
I remember my geography teacher discussion saying Nambudripad. And the fact that how he came under this great influence of the communist leaders like A.K. Gopalan. I mean, it's amazing the panoply of people who had...
Oh, yeah. You know, again, no disservice to him, but because of the character. But, you know, when I was reading this book, I got this feel of Forrest Gump. Because if you've seen the movie, Forrest Gump sort of interacts or comes across every famous historical person. And they're all here, whether it's Subhash Chandra Bose or whether it's Nehru or, you know, it's everyone. And I remember in his last visit to New York, when he was like 90, you said that he was catching up with his, you're giving it away. catching up with his old friend, Tommy Hilfiger. I was like, Tommy Hilfiger to something which is all on t-shirts, and that too when you're like, you know, someone's gifting it to you and it's actually in person and he's sitting there and having coffee with him. But, you know, what is the impact of, you know, someone like Nair and the more you, Captain Nair, and you spoke to people like Vijay Amritraj and his, you know, the people who know of his journey. And at the end, you also spoke about him being a Kerala boy and how much he worked to also bring in the airport and stuff. So what has been the impact of someone like Captain Nair in the social fabric of Kerala in terms of where it was and where it is today? Do you think that, you know, having people like him in front of them, and his example made a difference because he did touch many lives. So I was just wondering about that.
Yes. Oh, yes. He was like considered a really iconic figure in Kerala. Mm. In fact, one of his daughters-in-law, Lakshmi, said that he, first of all, he would be very, very generous to the entire extended family. And that was also a great deal due to his wife, Leela. I mean, like Leela, who he named his hotels after, she was such a guiding force in his life, And he's kind of seen her as a schoolgirl,
Yes.
But in Kerala, the kind of impact that he made, because he got them that airport, he got the extension of the railway station. But the point is that Kerala served him, really the worst, because
I know hotel in Kerala, yeah, hardly was the last
Andrew hotel kind of caused him so much,
yeah,
problem with Achyutanandan, who kind of was really a thorn in the flesh and kind of drove him pretty mad. Then
yes.
Matsubhumi kind of printed a story about how he had robbed two coconut trees, and it was ridiculous because,
and for someone who's planted so many trees,
planted a million trees and who's done so much, and in fact he says it, that anyone who read that story would have found it laughable,
yes.
He's not so poor. But I think, I think I kind of mentioned this because I found this just at the time of the Tokyo Olympics, about this coach, and it said that, however far they travel, they still nurture the son of the soil. And we all know about the Malayali network, which
was
working. We used to call it the Malnet. And also the way it kind of spreads. So, there is this kind of conflicting thing that who does he think he is? And at the same time, oh my God, like he has done so much for Kerala. But then I suppose in Kerala, everybody thinks that everybody has done so. They're a lot like the Bengalis.
Oh yes, the chip on our shoulders.
The communism, the rice, the
football.
The football, yeah.
Afternoon sleep.
Afternoon
sleep. No, but I do wonder that, people from, say, his village or some of the lower caste communities, his caste and all that. I mean, he must have been a bit of an idol, right? I mean, you would want to grow up like him, perhaps. Like say, you mentioned Bengal. I mean, I'm sure at one point, I don't know how it is now, but so many people would have wanted to grow up to be a Saurav Ganguly, completely right. Different field.
Correct.
So,
people in Kerala would want to grow up as Captain Nair?
No, I'm saying that, would he have, because he came from a background where no one would have hoped to have risen there.
Kalyan. I think his role models, A.K. Gopalan, yes, and yes, because those were in college. But then the kind of people like, Khan, Abdul Ghaffar Khan. He was directly in touch with, this young wireless officer. But so I asked, I said, how did he manage to get into that circle? So he said, no, one of his colleagues in the wireless office, was one of his relatives. And so that's why he tagged along. Then, Chinmayanand, he wanted to become the sannyasi. And then he said, no, you better be a karma yogi, because you're not going to sit cross-legged on the banks of the Ganga, that kind of thing. Then Netaji, who he met only later, but he went to the Haripura
conference.
And here again, he was this young man, but while he was the wireless officer, he was, listening to these really stirring speeches of Netaji. And then, when he came to Bombay, then he kind of was ADC to General Brar. And
who did the operation Blue?
But that was later.
But I'm saying that's the class of people.
Kind of used his contacts. So now he found Morarji Desai. So when he wanted to go back and do the handloom, sector, he immediately, pressed the right buttons for Morarji and said, I want to do this. And in fact, Morarji asked him, are you a congressman? So he said, no, but I'm a nationalist, And the story that I absolutely love about his audacity is the Leela lace and how he got the machines. Because imagine, shall I say the story?
Yeah, please do. And I must say at this point, I did this before also, but since he's one of the 14 people who watches, like the moment my mom-in-law saw this book, she told Kaina, I was like, yeah, Leela lace. We had Leela lace curtains and stuff And then, like you told me later, every Parsi will have some lace something.
Lace, yeah, is their white wedding sarees. In fact, that's what. So here's this Kerala boy who's never seen a piece of lace. I mean, yeah. Kerala, the nuns used to do the most exquisite lace, but I don't think young Krishnan Nair was anywhere near that. Mm. And his wife sees this lace for the first time on a trip to England and says, "We must make it." And when Leela has a will, then Mr. Nair has to find a way. The biggest influence of his life was not influence, but the biggest door opener was V.P. Menon.
Yeah.
And I really liked the chapters that I wrote. I devoted a whole chapter to V.P. Menon because it was just so interesting. And my friend Geeta Doctor, another great writer on food, she kind of, showed, I asked her because I wanted to know about Kerala food. But more than that, I sort of got this whole V.P. Menon inside. And that's the exciting thing about writing, that, you think this is a door, but the door doesn't open. And instead, the most fabulous window opened up.
Wow, that's a lovely way looking at it.
That happened so much with the Nanavati book and certainly with the Captain Nair book. And so this whole V.P. Menon and V.P. Menon and...
So you're telling us about the machines for the lace and how he... sort of imported them.
Yes. So, when he said, V.P. Menon said, if you want lace, then the only place to go to is England, Scotland, actually. And so he went, and then, of course, V.P. Menon took the precaution of, activating his contacts and not any old contacts. And who was the contact but Lord Mountbatten himself? So,
Forrest Gump again. Forrest Gump.
So, when he goes to this person, the people who make the looms, and this unknown man wants to see them and wants to buy lace, and of course that very uppity gentleman says, but I don't know you, how can I sell you my machinery? So he says, well, sir, maybe you'd like to speak to somebody who might convince you, and may I use your telephone? So he says, well, certainly. So he picks up the phone and he says, just a moment, sir, and he hands the phone to this gentleman, and there's like Lord Mountbatten at the other end of the line. And so this man, really falls off his chair. And so I think, that's the whole audacity, this whole chutzpah of this man,
In fact, that's something that struck me. And I wanted to ask you about that, a lot of us sort of grew up at the time of the cusp of liberalization, so to speak, when India became liberalized. And a lot of people now have sort of grown up in that environment. And a lot of the belief is that, the India really became a multinational force or a global force in terms of business after that. And you had the Nadellas and, so many people and the Tatas buying the Jaguar and whatnot. But, and that nothing happened before the early to mid 90s and before the economy was opened and we were a controlled economy and a protected economy and socialist and depending on Russian handouts and all of that. But here you have someone like Captain Nair and there are actually more as well who are out there like, rubbing shoulders with the tycoons from, the first world and often like, shouldering them out. So, what's your take on that?
But really, that is really so true, Kalyan, because, the kind of hotels that this man built, he really kind of wanted this total, sometimes maybe a bit over the top luxury, including like the width of his toilet paper was also bigger, the pressure of his shower curtain. And I always really wonder that, where does this come from? There's a boy who's grown up in Kannur eating gruel for lunch. M.S. Oberoi, same thing, unknown, place bound, in undivided Punjab. Where do they get the wherewithal to even think? I mean, okay, you bring in a lot of foreign experts, you do all that, but just to make that leap of faith is like just so amazing. And so, like, even with the good thing about or the distinctive thing about Captain Nair was that he wanted to showcase India. In fact, one of the other titles which we would have also loved was for Guest and Country, because yes, he wanted to, he was flamboyant, he wanted to show himself off, but honestly and truly, he wanted to show what India could be. And he really was a person who kind of said that, look, he built his hotels modeled on the ancient heritage. Every hotel had the vibe of the state that it was in. Goa had Hampi, Hampi. Bangalore had, the Mysore Palace. Delhi didn't have, that kind, but it had the sandstone, of Oblatians. And Udaipur, he kind of really, again, the whole Mewar culture right down.
And the fact that he greened, the area out of outside Sahar Airport in Mumbai, because he didn't want people to see people sort of plucking flowers. But that was so far-reaching. So
exactly. He just stayed the course and he said that I want to show the ancient heritage but with modern systems. And I think that was his singular contribution in addition to the greening. I mean, no other hotelier has, or industrialist has really, perhaps maybe with the exception of the Godrejes, but then, they were limited to Mumbai. But everywhere else, I mean, the kind of greening that this man did, and some of his loveliest stories are about, how he got plumeria. This man is driving down Brazil. He sees these plumerias, which are like our champa, but they are in different colors. And so he scales a wall and then, goes to this completely bruised little gardener and says, look, can I? And then he hands him this $100 note in return. And every time, as his granddaughter said, we always came back with two suitcases full of saplings.
This Samyukta Nayak.
Right. So this greening was like, and I think that was perhaps his proudest, when he got.
Because even in the 60s and 70s, when, India was in such a defensive position, I remember even when we were in Iran, maybe we lived for a couple of years before the revolution, Indians were referred to as fakirs and so on. But at that point, for him to go and get supply to Brooks Brothers and stay at the Waldorf Astoria.
And I would really like to bring in the parallels, and that's why I'm so glad that I did the Oberoi book earlier, because it really did give me so much of depth and heft and background. And it was very much like M.S. Oberoi also, he has this courage, he fails the exam for UPSC, and then he kind of goes up to this British manager of the of Cecil
Shimla.
Waits for him to come out for lunch and just sort of is very well polished and groomed. The same thing that Captain Nair does when he goes for the job to the British colonel for the army. And the fact that what I wrote in the Oberoi book, and really very much here, that when India had the image of the begging bowl, he was writing a new definition of luxury.
Exactly.
Both Captain Nair and M.S. Nair thought nothing of showing the door. M.S. Oberoi and Captain Nair showing the door. M.S. Oberoi showed the door to Sheraton because he didn't like what we told him, everything that he was being told. PL 480 was the time at that time, and really the begging bowl. And this man, dispensed with four seasons. Because he wasn't
in Goa
for this man to call the shots and say you can't stay in the hotel, which was his damn hotel. But then he learned, he learned from his daughter-in-law as the kind of understudy, and she picked up everything as to how a grand, truly global five-star hotel should, what goes into it, the spine, the skeleton of it. And then of course with each hotel there was a new learning. So these are amazing stories, they really are.
And I'm so glad that you've chronicled it, because sometimes we forget the past, but the past is the foundation on which the present is built. Because, one hears a lot of stories today about how the growth of India is coming from its heartlands, and really so, whether it's, cricket and IPL or politics or even writers and industrialists and so on. But I mean, these are the people who did it first, from deep inside Kerala, deep inside Punjab. I mean, the fact that people today are doing it is great, but I think that they also need
going
to sort
against
of,
this man, not everything possible, internal forces, external forces. Here he's building this grand hotel in Bangalore, bigger with more rooms than the combined room strength of the Oberoi and the Taj. And people are saying, has the man gone mad? In very much the same way that Dorabji Tata Sir Dorab Tata said when Oberoi bid for the land, which is still under the sea, and he said, Rai Bahadur, have you gone mad? You know, it's the same thing. Yes. We need this degree of madness, I think. So Hatko happened, it blocked 200 crores of his money. Everyone begged of him to cut down on Bangalore. Instead, he added more rooms. So with the same thing in Udaipur, you know, just about everything went wrong, including at the last minute, even the lake dried up. You know, but he still went ahead and like Hannibal, you know, we'll find a way or make it. You know, that sort of thing. But, you know, it takes something, you know, really.
It also takes something to start at 65 to, you know, create a hotel empire like that. So what's your take on that? I mean, what was going on in his mind then? Yeah, sure. Yeah, so I was saying that what possessed him at the age of 65 to, you know, start a hotel chain. I mean, and that's not any hotel chain.
You know, Kalyan, it's all of a piece with the India story that he wanted to write or to project. And, you know, he had seen all these luxury hotels when he used to travel in the salesman days, you know, when he had the audacity to, you know, tell Hilton, well, you know, I'm staying on, you know,
Seventh floor, not in like a budget hotel. Yeah. He was staying at the Hilton Waldorf Astoria and going to suites higher than where you had to meet people and say,
tipping the bellboys and all that so that he would get the salutes and be shown. Yeah. So he had no compunctions or, you know, about any of that. And then he'd been, you know, seeing these fabulous hotels and he said, I must do something like this. And he was nurturing this dream for a long time. And once again, Leela, you know, they had got this bungalow in when they wanted to start the factory. And so they had got this old Keku Gandhi's bungalow, really.
Mm.
And it
in Andheri.
Yeah, it was in the, you know, village, I mean, at that time. Mm. But then the International Hotel came up there.
Apple.
And Leela, the wife, you know, looks out of a window and sees this line of dusty taxis, you know, heading towards the airport. And she says, airport, international airport, how can there not be an international hotel? And then, so this man, you know, moves heaven and earth, defies Antule, who's sitting on the files because he's, well, you know, there are always these hotel stories.
Yeah.
You know that, the other hotels are kind of, you know, sabotaged.
Yeah, even Taj Calcutta had it. So.
Taj Calcutta, and I mean, that was
actually. I remember once chatting with Camellia Punjabi. And
the story and I broke, Kalyan, I can tell you that.
Wow, I mean, and you were in Calcutta then?
Yeah, I was in the Statesman. Everyone was writing this story from the environment that, oh, the zoo hotel will come. Mm. And it
all the yeah.
But then I, again, with my journalistic training, asked the next question. And I said, which are these migratory birds which are going to get affected? And they said, oh, well, not the ones which will boost and not the ones which will come through here and not. Anjali, please don't make this noise. So then I told her, I said, please, no cooker, no mixer. And she's rattling.
No, I remember the first time I did a live recording years back. Our cook, and I told her, you now be in that corner, don't come anywhere near. And she decided to make mutton. And with the pressure going every 30 seconds, I was like, oh, God. But yeah, anyway, that's the story of our age.
It is the story of our age, yeah. And work from home, I think, has made everyone accept it.
Yes, yes, absolutely. Yeah. Ah, so you were telling us about Leela.
Then I decided this story and I came back to my editor and I said, I'm sorry, but this is not an environment story. It's a kind of a corporate style.
Yeah.
And I kind of went ahead and I did it. It was called Zoo Hotel Controversy, Strictly for the Birds. And I will also tell you, show off a bit and
say, trademark Bachi Karkariya
Panel. This was put, you know, as part of the, when the cases were being fought, mm-hmm. and they put it as part of the evidence in court. And the judge said, you know, this is a journalist who I greatly respect. And he did take it on board. Because I was doing a lot of local stories in the Statesman at that time.
We used to read the Statesman. My grandfather said, if you want to learn English, then listen to the Statesman. Read the Statesman, listen to Doordarshan News.
Yeah. And really, so that was the thing that, he just sort of said that, no, I will, you know, stay this course. And he you know, he managed it.
No, the story has
about the Sahar Hotel was that Antule was kind of sitting on the file saying no urban land sealing, but the point was that Urban Land Sealing Act was not applying to hotels, And but once again, he got a kind of a guardian angel in Basant Dada Patil, who was like the strong man of Bombay. And he says, you don't worry, I will be coming to Bombay. And sure enough, Antule got into his whole thing because of the cement scandal. And he had to be, and when his hotel got built, the same thing, even while it was being built, he was in Delhi. And the Indian Express carried a story saying, the 17 rules are being broken by the government for the Nair's hotel. And, you know, again, all hell broke loose in Parliament. But again, that's when he went to his whole Kerala, you know, MPs and said, look, you know, this is not true because, you know, my hotel is not breaking any rules at all. And it was the same with the Oberoi Hotel, where they said, oh, it will come in the flight path of the birds. And there were so many bigger towers in the vicinity. Yes. So these are gorgeous stories. I mean, that's what makes your book.
And Chatpata.
Chatpata, yes, Chatpata, as Shobha put it.
She did it. Okay, I found another very interesting thing about this book that the fact that it's real life at the end of it, so it doesn't end the way a Hindi film would, perhaps maybe a bit more like, say, a British film would, because, you know, there's this entire build-up of Leela and all the, you know, the things, and then all the palaces which he did and all the things which he surmounted, and then finally it all imploded, right? I mean, eventually, like you kept referring to it at various points, and finally the debt sort of thing. Yeah, and until that was part, classic Basi again, but it's sort of imploded. It reminded me a lot of like India's 2007 World Cup campaign, where you know, or was it 2003, where we lost in the finals. So what's your take on that? I mean, you've been commissioned to write the story of someone. So I mean, you would want to show the person in all glory. And then the end is not so glorious from a rational point of view.
That's the truth, right, Kalyan?
Yeah. So what's your take on that?
A halo. A halo is really the last accessory you should have with the biography. Yeah.
And also the family, also sort of the way they handled it and moved on.
Yes,
was
and
a learning.
Everybody knows that the Leela Hotel group had to be sold to Brookfield. So there was no way that you could gloss over it. And of course, it took me a lot of, you know, a challenge for me to write the whole thing of the EBITDA and, you know, the Excel sheets and how it kind of worked out. And it was, you know, a combination of external and internal factors. You know, they were going well. They had issued these foreign currency convertible bonds. Their shares were skyrocketing. So they were sure that they would get, you know, be able to recoup their losses. But then Lehman Brothers happened.
I mean, no one's, it's like, it's the coronavirus.
Then the economic downturn happened. 26/11 happened. Sorry, 9/11 happened.
9/11.
And so everything went for a six. And I kind of wrote, you know, when I put it, I said, you know, it was, you know, both Shakespeare and Yeats, you know, vaulting ambition that overreached itself. And Yeats, things fall apart, the center does not hold. You know, so, you know, this whole combination of factors, and there was no way that you could gloss over it. And it was very clear in my mind that I would not.
So is there any learning from this phase of their life? Because we've had many learnings about how we went up, but is there any learning about how he and the family, who's sort of inherited his values in a sense, the way they handled this phase? Because, you know, one often sort of learns the most during failure, so they say. So is that a cliche, or do you see that in their lives? The fact that failure teaches you stuff.
While this whole, you know, for so many years, the buzz in the market and in the media was, it's been sold. So they really had to even island their guests, you know, make sure that the guests were not, more than that, they had to kind of shore up their staff, because there was you know, when the jungle drums beat, then the headhunters come into play, you know. Yeah.
And also fear, you know, the parallel which came to mind is Jet Airways and Kingfisher.
And in fact, when, you know, I can't remember the quote, but, you know, it's someone's quote who says that, you know, in the darkest hour, you know, people do kind of rise, and while all this was happening, they were getting best hotel of the world.
I know.
So, yeah, but I think maybe what the family may have learned is that, and maybe the family, I don't know whether the sons have that killer streak that the old man had, you know, but, and now they're in businesses which, you know, which may not call for that kind of, you know, ambition. And they, I think they have certainly, they've had their fingers burned, but I think it's really their good karma, because I mean, look at it, Kalyan, they have pulled out, made their pile, I mean, made their money, you know, sold to Brookfield before the economic downturn really starts. And then COVID well. Happens, because can you imagine if they were faced with all this, and as I wrote, I said, even if maybe if they didn't go laughing to the bank, certainly they went smiling into the sunset.
Yes. And like you said, I mean, the next generation is now writing their stories, like Samyukta's with her, you know, with her father, the restaurants which they're doing in right. London.
And she's doing very well. And
So, okay. So now I'm going to give you the chance to sit on the soapbox. And then, since we also have a book to sell, why should people read this book? I'll tell you why my take. If you are
looking for a book, why should I say it?
Okay, I'll tell you why. If you, first of all, are the sort who likes to lie down in a couch or maybe soak in a tub, okay, that's a bit this thing, and read a book, I think this is it. It's really interesting. It's more like a Jeffrey Archer novel than a real life, but it's real life, which makes it astonishing. It also tells us stories about different facets of our country before independence, after independence, and also parts of the country which are not that spoken of, because we are a more north-dominated narrative, and there's a story from the south. It also is of interest to people who follow economics, politics, and yet without it being really heavy and boring. And it's probably the only hardcover which I've carried with me during a travel and not regretted it also. So it's really a page turner, but it's real life. But yeah, so that's what I feel. And how do you feel about having written this book, you know, in the middle of lockdown?
Good. And I feel really very good, because with because it's not a quickie. It may have been written in 7 months, but that's the way I work. I mean, Nanavati case, I didn't even have a basis of a autobiography. I did that in 1 year, and nobody can deny the research that went into that book, you know, and really dense.
And in a judicial thing, you have to be very careful about libel.
And really to those judgments, I mean, that kind of, I had to really steel myself, because the stories of, you know, Nanavati and the court and Lucy Karanja and Karl Khandalawala, they were all fantastic. But if I had not had the rigor, the journalistic rigor, and for this, I must really, really still remember my first boss, Kushwant Singh, you know, who just taught you to ask the next question, to walk the extra mile, who gave you that you know, that confidence when you were just a trainee, and gave you cover stories, and you had to work to, you know, to sort of live up to it. So, you know, if I had not had that rigor and gone to those judgments, I would have still gone to that same old cliche, the unmitigated villain, the unalloyed hero, you know, the poor, you know, poor hypnotized wife. And, you know, my Nanavati book upturns all those cliches. So in the same way here, I mean, if I had not got into, I could have just written, you know, I had 7 months, I mean, the Nayars wanted a book, I could have done it. But I've done all the research into Kerala history, into our own Indian history, the time of the freedom struggle, the Congress, conferences, VP Menon, the colorful characters of the past. Mm. And then even the whole business stories, Hatko, you know, Lehman Brothers, you know, those are not, I'm not a business writer, but I think you take each book as a challenge for something where you learn something new. And I think that is where I approach every project of mine. Maybe not, I mean, it may sound very pompous, but certainly if there was no learning in it, I would not be interested. And I always tell the journalist class, which classes, the media classes that I teach, that, you know, the day you stop learning is the day that you can just stop giving up this job. Because the most wonderful thing about a journalist job is that there is a learning every day. And there's a learning from a huge, huge, you know, cast of characters. You know, you'll be at the Raj Bhavan in the, you know, in the morning, and in the slum, you know, in the afternoon. So I think that is what, you know, has kept me going. And these are fabulous stories. I love this Tom Wolfe quote, which I have at the time of the Nanavati book, was that it says that the trouble with fiction is that it has to be plausible. But I think writing nonfiction is to try to make it plausible, because, you know, the twists and turns in this story are unbelievable.
My first WhatsApp to you after I read this, started reading this book, and I said that, look, I need to push this interview. Is all of this real?
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much, Bachi, for writing this book and for introducing Captain Nair to so many of us, and going beyond maybe what could have been a whole hotel, or maybe a fabric or a lace to this thing. And also thank you for this lovely masterclass on writing and journalism at the end, which I know I'm going to cherish, and I'm sure many, many of our readers. So thank you, Bachi. Folks, this is the book, Capture the Dream, and you'll get it in bookshops, but online is, I think, easier and simpler. But go out there and read it, and don't think of it as a business book or a biology or a hotel book. If you're looking at something which to sort of rev up your reading genes again, reading the same DNA, then this could do it.
You're very kind, Kalyan. Thank you very much.
Absolute pleasure. Thank you. Thank you so much. Bye.
Bye.